Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family.
Welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. Today I've got Kit Farrow joining me again. It's been a few months now, I think, since I've had you on, but I was thinking on topics that I'd want to talk to you about. And usually what I do is think, what are questions that I would have for Kit that maybe somebody else would get some enjoyment out of? And the question that I was kind of thinking about is, well, Kit has built and grown fairly successfully, quite successfully, a business, not just a cattle business and a, you know, a profitable type of cattle model, but he's built a large business both in production ranching, but also in marketing and the Farrow Cattle Company program. And that's not something that many people do. I think I was just checking the other day in 2023 or two or whatever, the last Seedstock 100, you were number 9 on the Seedstock 100. That's a pretty incredible accomplishment, and not just anyone can do that. So I wanted to talk to Kit a little bit about his tips, his thoughts, and his advice kind of related to building a business, from the perspective of just, you know, building a business well and choosing to go down that path. So I apologize at the beginning of this here too, that I'm kind of at the end of a cold. So if I sound a little funky this week, it's because I got a bit of a sore throat, but I think we'll be able to get through this just fine. And I'll let Kit do most of the talking, which he's usually pretty good at. So Kit, thanks so much for joining me and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast.
Yeah, it's always good to be here, Jared.
Well, I appreciate you doing it, and I'll just kind of turn it over to you a little bit right away. And well, the first question I guess I'll kind of ask you is, you know, I asked you about this business that you've built, but what was it about you or your upbringing that even led you to want to start a business at all? It's pretty easy to just go and carry on working or, you know, finding jobs. There's a lot more security. A lot of people find security and comfort just in having a regular job with a steady paycheck. And something about you, you said, I want to start a business. Was there something to that?
I hope so. I'm glad you presented this the way you presented it to me. I took lots of notes, and, you know, it's good for somebody my age to look back and say, okay, what did happen? Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure. I think most people that grow up in rural areas have the, you know, a goal of, you know, I want to be my own boss. I want to be self-employed. I know I did, you know, before I was 10 or 11 years old, and I set a goal, and I said, you know, by the time I'm 30 years old, I want to be self-employed. Mm-hmm. Now, why I did that, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I beat that goal by 2 years. When I was 28 years old, I left the cowboy job at a feedlot and went to, you know, started a new business that really didn't exist, where we were selling and installing wood stoves and solar systems. That opened up, some of you are old enough to know, in 1980, there were some really good energy tax credits available through the state and federal governments. And that basically opened up that business. And 5 years later, it closed that business, you know, when they took the tax credits away. But I would say, you know, first and foremost, you know, if you want to start a successful business, you need to be a goal setter. And you need to have the determination to make those goals, turn them into reality. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about goals. You know, I think we all have a tendency to write down, you know, when I was 10 years old, this was my goal. We all have a tendency sometimes to pick a goal that is too big to accomplish quick enough. And that discourages us. It's kind of like setting New Year's resolutions, you know, and I've learned mostly I learned this through the Ranching for Profit EL board that I was on for 1 year. You know, you can eat a whole elephant, but you got to do it one bite at a time. And, you know, you've got to set little goals that are easier to make, that are leading you towards your big goal. But I think number one, if you want to start a business, a successful business, you've got to be, driven and a goal setter those sort of things.
Yeah. And well, I've got one question, because something we were talking about here in your kind of conversation about you're running your business that you've got is that you should love what you do. And I'm curious, I'm assuming that you were a cattleman, you grew up a cattleman, you always loved cattle, and you chose to leave a business or a job that was within cattle to run a business that was with not within cattle, probably not something you loved or were super passionate about, wood, fire, stoves, and solar. I'm curious, was that something that you kind of had to give up one goal of maybe doing something you enjoyed to start another, or to follow another goal of working for yourself, but maybe it was a little less passionate? Was that something you had to balance?
I don't think I ever thought of that. I think my goal of being self-employed trumped everything else.
Sure.
And I was, I was very passionate about alternate energy sources and those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I have the ability to, whatever I'm doing, if I can't be passionate about it, I'm not going to do
sure.
it. But I was just as passionate about that as I am about cows today.
Okay. That makes sense.
So I was tired, a feedlot, kind of a smelly place. And when it rains, it's a mess. And I was just tired of,
sure.
I think the winter before I quit, I wore out several pairs of overshoes, just that,
yeah.
That's it. That just wasn't fun.
Yeah.
And again, in the back of my mind was this goal that you need to be self-employed. But the next thing I want to talk about is it's really easy to let a job hold you captive. I mean,
yeah.
I had to think hard and long about leaving that job I had. It paid well. It was, I knew every day what I was going to be doing, blah, blah, blah. It was my comfort zone. And I see way too many people that would love to be self-employed, but they can't leave their comfort zone. They can't leave that security. When you create your own business, there's risk involved. I mean, it's, you start thinking about all the what ifs, what if you fail? What if this, what if that? And a long time ago, I learned to ask myself, what's the worst that can happen? And I'm not the only one. I mean, anybody can do ask the same question. What's the worst that can happen? What if it does fail? You start a business and it fails. I had the ability then, and now I could go out and get a job tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like there's only one opportunity for me to work. I can get a job anywhere, anytime I want, and most people can't. So, you have to put that behind you.
Yeah. Well, I think they talk about jobs are masters, or companies are masters at figuring out just what they need to pay you to keep you coming back, but not enough to get you really free. Like, they've kind of got it figured out, and it's pretty appealing, but yeah.
I just see too many people, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, but too many people just will not leave the comfort zone of that business or that
mm-hmm.
job. And I have no problem with that. I mean, if that's what you want to do, but don't have a job you don't like when you could be doing something you do like,
mm-hmm.
because you are in control of that. You can't overthink everything. I don't analyze things that much. My gut feeling says, go do that. You're going to like it. You're going to make money doing it.
Yeah.
Now, 90% of the time, my gut feeling's not 100% right.
Mm-hmm.
It's every business I've been in was not as lucrative and successful as I thought it was going to be in the beginning. But you deal with that and you just change, you make those adjustments. But I know people, I'm related to people that will talk themselves out of anything that comes along simply by, overthinking it.
Yeah.
I'm glad I don't do it that way. I'm glad that I have to make some readjustments. And this kind of gets back to, if you want to create a successful business, you must be all in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to start talking about jobs again. In the beginning, you may have a full-time job, and you may be, while you're trying to start a new business of your own. But I don't think, as long as you've got a full-time job, that business is not going to be as successful as it can be. You can't be all in if you're working a job. And, I'll branch off a little bit And this has been some recent experience I had. I had a speaking engagement with a group of cattlemen, about 150 cattlemen in Alabama, within the last 3 weeks. And every one of these guys own cows. I would say 80% of them have a full-time job. And because of that, their business is never going to be that profitable or successful. Their job is holding them back. Their job is their security blanket. I won't use names, but I know that the starting generation on this one place was a registered Simmental breeder. He also had his own meat market. He butchered his own cattle. I mean, this guy was doing it all. He was an entrepreneur. The next two generations are driving a school bus. Mm-hmm. And the fourth generation is a little girl in high school that loves cows and can't think of anything but cows. And she's not going to have a place to go back to because her dad and grandpa are not building a business. I mean, they not a successful business. They'd rather drive a school bus than successful.
And I'd even share my personal, kind of connection to that. When I came home from college, I was full-time on the farm, and that was great. I really enjoyed it, put a lot of mental and physical energy and capacity into that. And then over the years, for whatever reason, started kind of branching out, thinking it was good to diversify and good to do other things, got into direct marketing, got into a part-time off-farm job with the Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota, got into real estate investing, got into podcasting, and had all these different things. And to your point, I've not been able to, I'm more exhausted now, mentally exhausted, burned out, trying to do all these different things and not feeling like you're doing any one of them right or to the fullest capacity that you can if you focused in on just one or two of them and stuff like that. And yeah, no, there's a lot of truth to being able to do that. Diversity is, well, it's always preached as good. It's important to be diverse, and I don't know what your thoughts are on, we talked about diversity, I think, in the past a little bit.
Yeah, we did. Warren Buffett says, diversity is for those that aren't very good at anything or something like that.
Diversity is a hedge against ignorance, I believe, is the quote he uses. Yeah.
Maybe, but if you're all in, and whether it's a wood stove or a cow or whatever, if you're all in, you'll make it work. Mm-hmm. If you don't have to make it work, it's probably not going to work. And one of my biggest concerns right now is, I'd like to share all of these thoughts with, some college students, because mm-hmm. that have come from a little family farm, but they can take that family farm and make it a business if they want to. That's a passion of mine, is to, let's get out of the job business and get into the real business.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my next thing is, I'm going to say, build a network, no matter who you are, what business you're talking about. I've spoke to several groups of college students over the years, and most of them have no idea where they're going to be 5 or 10 years from now. And I said, doesn't really matter. Start building a network of people, get names, get phone numbers, get email addresses, store them up somewhere, send something out to them once in a while, just a communication, in 1994, when I came back to the ranch in 1985, where I came to the ranch I'm on in 1994, I mailed my first newsletter, and that went out to about 200, pretty much local ranchers and people that I knew. And it was well received. That just kind of encouraged me. I went from 200 to 1,000 to 5,000 to 10,000 subscribers. And, that became a huge passion of mine, but I think it made our business successful. If you don't, network with other people and communicate with other people, it's pretty hard to be a lone ranger and do anything successfully. I just checked yesterday. We currently have over 20,000 active subscribers.
Wow.
But if you look at my database, there's another 35,000 that are no longer active. I mean, they're dead, they're whatever, but that's 55,000 people in my data.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, well, they always talk about it. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And in a business that's, well, in any business, if to scale, you have to be able to connect and expand your reach with it beyond the people in your immediate community. And so, no, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And so on that building a network, people talk a lot about you got to give value before you can get value. Was that a priority of yours from the start of what you were sending out? What were you providing that made or brought 55,000 people to your network?
As most of your subscribers know, you know, when we got into the beef business, it was in the, you know, everybody else is trying to make their cows bigger as fast as they can, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, my dad was still alive at that time. Chip Hines was a mentor of mine, but we all said, you know, this doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. It's a, you know, bigger cows is not the answer to, you know, profit. Profit's the only thing we really want to maximize. It's not cow size. Mm-hmm. And I remember Chip saying, you know, you're going against the grain. Everything you're saying is totally different than what everybody else is preaching and teaching. He says, you're going to have to teach people why you are doing what you're doing. And that was a, you know, the first newsletter. That was before I even knew. I don't even know if they had email back then, but so I sent out, a one page article, which kind of shared my thoughts on beef production. And, you know, when man's in control, it goes backwards. If we let Mother Nature be in control, we'll go forward. And that's pretty much why we did that. But I don't really know why I was so passionate to grow that list, but I'm glad I did. You know, that's, and when you start saying things that are totally anti-status quo, you know, that's when I started getting asked to several speaking engagements, and every speaking engagement, you may increase your list by 100 to 500 people.
So that was going to be my next question is how did you actually grow that list? Because I think when I had Joel Salatin on, I asked him how he grew, like, how did he become Joel Salatin? And he talked about reaching out to and hitting up a bunch of different groups like Rotary clubs and different things, getting out in front of people and just connecting with people in whatever way he could. And it sounds like you kind of answered it there, but I'll maybe let you expand upon how you built this network. Because, you know, it's not just going to be you send it out to 200 people and they share it with their friends and family, and all of a sudden you've got 50,000 people who are following your newsletter.
There's a lot of word of mouth. Again, you know, when I was invited to speak so many times, you know, it's they used me to open some eyes. But I remember, you know, I was taking farm and ranch magazines, and I'd go through the sale barn reports. And back then, they would show a name and an address. Well, I just started subscribing people that sold cows. That's probably not the right way to do it. But I'd say a good share of those said, you know, were thankful that they were receiving our newsletters.
Yeah. Well, it might have been Rob Pierce who said that somebody signed him up for the newsletter. He didn't know where he started getting it. one of the cooperative producers, I think when I had him on, I think that's what he said was one of my church members or something signed me up for this Kit Farrow's newsletter. So you're not the only, unless you did it, you're not the only one out just signing people up at random, I guess.
No. But I think a network, you know, I don't care if you're a car salesman or mm-hmm. or have a job, you know, that network is going to be powerful. You know, the last 20 some years have been drought years for us. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're sending out something to 10,000 people or 20,000 people and you say, you know, I've got cows that I need to find homes for, you know, that's huge.
Yeah.
You know, back in the early 2000s, we sent cows to Missouri, mostly Iowa, Oklahoma, and nearly every one of those places we sent cows to became cooperative producers. You know, that grows your business too, but you can't do that if you don't have a network of people.
I'm curious, and I don't know if this is something you even want to talk about specifically. I can cut it out, but was it intentional in your cooperative producers that you picked too? Because I know, well, David Hall and Bobby and some folks who are CPs now had markets of their own. And I'm wondering if it's something that's some intentionality to it, or if it just kind of worked out that way, or if that's something to be learned, I guess, when you're building businesses, the people you connect yourselves can be strategic too, as well, that might have their own networks that you can tie into when you connect with someone else in a similar field. If that makes any sense, what I'm asking.
When we took a producer on as one of our producers who had been doing their own marketing, I mean, that was part of the deal. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've been selling 100 bulls a year, using our genetics, using our philosophies, I want your mailing list.
Yeah.
And you know, there's, and they would want me to have their mailing list.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it works together, you know.
Yeah.
In a lot of businesses, you know, marketing is more important than production. And you know, that's true of this business. You know, if you can produce the best gadget or cow or whatever in the world, but if you don't know how to get it to the people that need it, you know, it's not going to work.
Yeah. And I just thought that was something of note that to pick out of your story was some intentionality with selecting of who your partners are going to be. And they, and that a lot of people, they'll start a business with a buddy because they're buddies. And that may not be the person that adds, they may not add any value to your business,
right,
to your relationships. They may not have any connections in the field you're going into business for. And if you're going to go into partnership in any way, whether it's something like this and some sort of a cooperative model or whatever, you know, find aligning strengths and things that are going to benefit both parties, I guess.
And we've grown to, you know, to where we have cooperative herds in 13 different states. You know, we had I guess we still do have a cooperative herd in Australia, but I'm no longer with that program.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's how we went from selling 6 bulls a year to over 1,000 bulls a year. You can't do it on your own. You got to work with people that are working with you. And, you know, I look back over the last 30 some years and say, man, I don't know how we did as much as we did. 30 years would be 1994. But, and I've got some short things I've kind of wrote down here, and I'll kind of hit on them. But I think it's, if you're going to start a business, you need to love what you do. You know, I could be a mortician, but I don't think I would love what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I appreciate those that do love what they're doing, but if you don't love what you do, you're not going to be successful. You're not going to be happy. And so, you know, don't try to start something that you really don't love or you're not passionate about.
Yeah.
And then I think you need to believe in what you do. And I've always thought, okay, I my business has to help people and solve problems. And I believe it does. And when you believe that, others believe that, and you know, it is true. If you're just in business to make a profit, you know, it's hard to believe in what you do.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of things that I probably couldn't do because I don't believe in it and I don't love it.
Well, it's just, I've met several cooperative producers, seed stock producers who have told me, it was actually at the Grassworks conference when you came and spoke. After you spoke, the table I was at was suddenly flooded with people. And I talked to some people and a couple, I've heard this in other spots too, where folks are like, I totally believe in your program. It makes so much sense, but I'm a seed stock producer for a bunch of people who don't love or who don't believe that and don't feel the same way, and there's this tension and this struggle with balancing what they believe in and what there's a demand for and in their particular market. You've gone out, and that's the value again of your network, is because when you started, what you believed in, there wasn't necessarily a demand for. You created the demand for it, so
right.
That's one thing, I guess, to take away from it too. But they talk about the triangle or whatever, like this overlap of what are we good at? what are we passionate about and what is there a demand for? And if you're lacking in the, if you're good at something and passionate about it and you enjoy it, but there's no demand, then I guess that's where you got to create the demand. And that's a unique thing to your story, where a lot of people find the ability to grow a business in something there's demand for, but you built it from scratch. And that's kind of, I just was out in Virginia speaking at the Virginia Forage and Grasslands tour. And they told me 20 something years ago that they had you out. And one individual said that you almost got ran off stage. And I think I've heard you say that that was maybe a common thing back in the day at some of the places that you would talk at, because there was a lot more disagreement with the philosophies that you've pioneered.
Yeah, it was, I never let it bother me. I was just bullheaded enough. And if you think you're right and you know you're right, and you know you have what people need, you know, you just can't slow down.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've never let that bother me, but I've talked to seed stock producers, that the same ones you've talked to, that know that we're on the right track, but they can't change their program because they can't change the thinking. But sooner or later, you know, if you, these farms and ranches are not making very much money, you know, change will have to come. But I feel sorry for those guys that can't make a business do what they believe in doing, because they're locked into an old paradigm.
Yeah, absolutely.
The next thing I want to say is you need to expect to make a profit. And that sounds kind of silly, but there's a whole bunch of cow-calf producers out there that don't even expect to make a profit. Part of that is because they have this off-farm job that they don't have to be profitable. But, you know, I would challenge, if you really want to have a on-farm job of your own, you know, your own business, you're going to have to get rid of that security of a job and expect to make a profit. If it's not profitable, it's not a business.
Yeah. And I guess I've talked with a lot of people about this. One of the things I like about the ranching for profit model and definition of profit is that it kind of separates itself from cash flow, and that it makes you demand a return on all your assets, your equity, your land, and your time that you may not otherwise account for. And if you're sitting, a lot of people get comfortable because they might have a little bit of cash flow, but it's being subsidized through off-farm work, paid for land, whatever the case is. And so, yeah, if you ever want to get to a point where you're fully self-employed, demanding a profit out of your business is going to be essential.
Something Kit and I probably didn't hit hard enough in this conversation is the importance of knowing your numbers and having good data to go off of. It is so essential to starting, operating, and growing a business to have good actionable data. And that's what the team at RanchRight LLC does, is they give you actionable data that you can use to move forward with confidence in growing and expanding your ranch business. If you're wondering what actionable data means, it means real numbers based on your business's financials. This data is so essential in running and operating any business. So if this is something that you're interested in, reach out to John Haskell and his team at RanchRightLLC.com.
It was. And when I, you know, I started that business in town selling wood stoves and solar systems. And, you know, in my mind, I was going to get rich quick. It didn't happen that way. But I did what I had to do to make it work. And, you know, that business was just as successful as any. I remember an acquaintance of mine coming into this. We had a retail store, and he came in probably within the first month after I opened. He says, "This is a white elephant. You won't be here 6 months from now." Well, I love people like that, because by golly, I'm going to show you wrong.
We'll see. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the reason we went out of that business was because of the tax credits. You know, they came in, the tax credits went out. I had the opportunity to at least 3,000 or 4,000 acres of grass and buy a commercial cow herd. I mean, that's when everything, just timing was perfect.
Yeah.
But I was probably going to do something on my own again when we got out of that business.
So can I ask that, just picking in a little more on your personal story there, you talked earlier about the fear of failure and, you know, kind of understanding what the worst case scenario was, and maybe the land base coming in, maybe you never had to actually deal with, oh man, this isn't going well, what do I do next? But was there a point where you were like, I mean, things changed, this business is struggling. Did you decide you needed, I don't know, what did that actual process look like? Like in the very real, you and your wife were sitting talking, trying to figure out what to do next.
Well, I'll talk about the ranching business, and that now we've turned it into a, you know, we produce and market breeding bulls to other ranchers. But in the beginning, I remember, you know, growing up on a small place that my dad had. My dad was born and raised in Denver, you know, so he had no bad traditions to break. And I think that helped me.
Sure.
But I was thinking, okay, I can buy 150 cows and make a good living. Well, that era was over. You know, my dad could have 150 cows and make a good living, but my cost of living was higher than that. So, you know, we started looking at other things that we could do. And the fact that we could not find any genetics that increased production per acre, everything that was out there increasing production per cow. And, you know, we had decided, okay, this is wrong. And that at that point, you know, that opened up some opportunities and said, okay, we're going to take what we have here. We're going to turn this commercial herd into a seed stock herd. And, you know, it doesn't take as many cows to make the same living if you're selling, you know, selling bulls for, you know, at that time we were selling bulls for $3,000 or something like that when, you know, a calf was worth $500.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And with the, I guess I'm curious too, even before that, before the business, and that's one pivot that you had to make when you realized the commercial business wasn't working, commercial cow business. But when you were doing that wood stove and solar business and you realized, oh, this isn't going to work anymore, these things have gone away, did you think, man, maybe we should have stayed with my job? Did you have questions, or did you doubt that maybe that wasn't the right decision and that guy was right, that I'm out of business after all?
I've never doubted anything. I mean, I've had to make some adjustments.
And I,
you know, when we left that store, closed that store down, we actually ran it again for another year from the ranch. But I had made up my mind when I had that store, I was always available to help somebody else finish a job somewhere. Mm-hmm. When I came to the ranch, I was always available for part-time help, but I told myself, you will not get another job.
Sure.
You know, and
yeah.
I think the fact that I didn't try to maintain a full-time job while I was starting a ranch is the reason I'm successful.
Yeah.
You know, I had to make it work. And if I had a job, I wouldn't have to.
Well, I look at a lot of your story and I think it's awesome. I have a lot of respect for what you did, because I feel like on the opposite end. A lot of the things you're saying don't do are the things I do. I'm over analytical, tend to think the worst, and it's ridiculous. I mean, it's funny, like the decisions that you make for some reason. Like I spent 3 or 4 years looking at rental properties before I bought the first one. And I'm not saying this is something that everybody should do, but it's an example I go back to because it's the one that I'm involved in, and was nervous for years thinking, what's the worst? Like somehow if I buy this, it'll sit empty for 4 years with no income and I'll just, you know, go broke. Like worst case scenario, very worst case scenario. I cover the cost of that mortgage out of pocket and I have an appreciating asset that would have gone up in more than the expenses that I put into it over those 4 years. But for some reason, the fear of the worst case scenario scared me. And I'm just very much impressed by your willingness. Like, I don't know if it's what it is, you know, low risk tolerance or low, high risk tolerance, or just, I guess the term you
not
use,
smart enough to know better.
It's not smart enough to know better, but you just pushed through and you just kept doing it. And, it's
you know, impressive. I think some of the most amazing things that have been done by individuals is because they didn't know it couldn't be done.
Yeah.
You know, and I, again, you know, there's a passion and I still have that passion, you know, even in my, you know, I'm getting older and older, but that passion just has never gone away. I know what we have is what nearly everybody in the cow-calf business needs. You know, our philosophies, our genetics, and man, that just gets you out of bed
Yeah.
on a run.
Yeah. That's cool.
The other next thing I'd like to talk about is, you know, being a contrarian, or what we call as a herd quitter. If I would have got into the ranching business or the seed stock business and tried to do everything like everybody else, I wouldn't have lasted 5 years. And I think that's, if you study, I think most seed stock programs last 5 years, you know, a high percentage of them, because they're just trying to duplicate, imitate somebody else. And, you know, you're, if somebody else is already doing what you're doing, there's not a need for you. So I think if you look back over history, you know, the guys that have made history are the ones that said the world's not flat, it's round. You know, they come across with a totally different look. And I don't think you ever run out of that.
Yeah. Well, you might be interested. I just finished the audiobook for the book Outliers, and it talks about a lot of those outliers, the people who created great change and all of the circumstances that that contributed towards those people making it. But it's interesting in your story, the timing in which you were born and got into business right when there was this shift happening in industry, and you saw a need for something different, and you capitalized on it. It's pretty cool. That's awesome.
Like I said, I've got several things kind of jotted down here.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's critical for a business person or wannabe business person to identify his unfair advantages. You know, I think we all, every person has an unfair advantage. And when we used to have our greet and meet pre-sale meetings with our customers, you know, we'd go around the room and ask them what their unfair advantage is. And it varied. But a lot of times the unfair advantage is that I grew up in the city and I didn't have anything to, any bad habits to break. Mm-hmm. But everybody has an unfair advantage based on his or her location, their personality, their experiences or lack of experiences, their family, their network of people. You know, recognize that and use it. Mm-hmm. And along the same line is, you know, if you can create a competitive advantage, do so. I think it might have been Warren Buffett. I remember Alan Nation quoting it, but I think it originated with Buffett. But if you can't, something about, you know, if you don't have a competitive advantage, you need to basically get out of business. And I think, you know, that there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
You know, but you've got to create that competitive advantage. And I've talked about this in newsletters and in updates, but there's two types of competitive advantages, and one's a cost advantage and one's a differential advantage. So the cost advantage is when a business is able to deliver the same product that a competitor's deliver for a lower cost. So if I can produce a calf for 50% of what my neighbors are producing a calf for, I'm always going to be profitable. That's a cost advantage. The other is a differential advantage, and that's, you need to create a product that is different, perceived to be different, and perceived to be superior to what others are producing. You know, you're doing some direct marketing, probably grass-fed beef and other meats and stuff, but,
yep,
you know, those food products are perceived to be better than what you buy in a grocery store, and people are going to pay you more for it. You know, that's a competitive advantage that you created.
Yeah. Yeah. And the cool thing about that one in particular is also, I can get into it at a cost advantage, I think, cost advantage, because I don't need a barn and a lot and feed bunks and a TMR mixer and a tractor. And, you know, you can get into a grazing based grass finished business and get both cost savings and differential advantage in a premium product and stuff. It's neat kind of an enterprise, but no, that makes a lot of sense.
So we were just talking about creating a business that has both a cost advantage and a differential advantage, and that a grazing based grass finished beef business can be the perfect business that captures this. Essentially, you're able to capitalize on reduced costs, reduced overheads of the grass finishing model, while also increasing the premium or the value of your product through adding a premium in a grass finished beef. And if you want to direct market this direct to consumer, you can add even more premium on top of that. However, if you want to get into direct marketing, something that's going to be incredibly important is having a good website. And that is why I recommend Barn to Door. Barn to Door is an all-in-one solution for farmers selling direct to consumer. My wife and I now have been using them for over 3 years. Barn to Door makes it easy for us to manage all of our sales both online and in person, and has helped us to increase sales for our farm business. If you're looking to build a successful farm business with best-in-class training and support, I'd encourage you to check out Barn to Door. You can go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, where you can learn more about our success. And if you choose to sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session that is a $99 value. Again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter.
A lot of our bull customers have both advantages.
Yeah.
And, if they can produce a calf for less than all their neighbors, if they can sell that calf for twice as much as their neighbors, that's huge. So if you're going to get into any business, you need to kind of think these things through and create those types of advantages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that I always harp on is changing with the times. If somebody tells you they like change, they're either certified nuts or they're lying to you. People don't like change. We're afraid of change. However, change is one of those things that is always going to take place. The present's different from the past. And the future will be different from the present. Nothing's going to stay the same. And I think I kind of forgot about this, but you have the bell curve, and you have the first people into something, and then the next group, and then everybody up.
Yeah.
Up here.
The adoption curve or whatever.
Adoption curve.
Yeah.
If you can be ahead of the curve, ahead of your competitors, when you see something that needs to be changed. And I think Faro Cattle Company, at one time we were so far ahead of the curve that, people made fun of us and just, I don't think we're that far ahead of the curve anymore. We've got enough people are coming on board with that same thinking, but you don't want to be the last to change. If you look around and you say, okay, I should have changed this last year, you're probably 10 years behind where you should have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think change is, I hate it as much as anybody else, but I guess I love to look for opportunities that everybody else is missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think one of the most powerful slides, I guess, that I have seen that I remember, Jim Garrish, he shared it in maybe discussion groups, and then also in his pre-sale talks where he shared like the increase in costs of different items over the last 50 years and how much that highlights how the industry has changed. The economic and cost structures of the business, the cow-calf business, is totally different than it was 50 years ago when you compare the cost changes to the value of our product changes, yet people continue to operate in the same way, if not in general and stuff. And so, yeah, the momentum is definitely starting to shift, though. It seems like all the articles and the industry stuff is starting to talk about moderating. So you're no longer quite as wild. Like I mentioned about Virginia, when I was out there, nobody ran me off the stage or threw anything at me. So I appreciate you taking the arrows. I guess maybe that's the case. Yeah,
let's talk a little bit about changes. 1970 is like 50 years ago, and both Jim and I have pretty much had the same message in trying to share the same things. My message, when you look at what people are doing today, most farmers and ranchers, is not much different than what they were doing in 1970. Mm-hmm. 1970, rural land, agricultural land, was selling for $200 an acre. I mean, that's hard to believe.
Yeah.
Today it's $3,800 per acre.
Mm-hmm.
1970, I could buy gasoline for 25, 35 cents a gallon. Can't do that now. A brand new pickup, you're not old enough to know, but what do you think a brand new pickup cost in 1970?
Oh, I feel like in the $7,000 range, something like
Less
that.
than
Oh,
5,000.
really? Wow. Yeah.
You know, and Jim will use an example of a big round baler, but the cost of all of our inputs has gone up way more, you know, 5 to 10 times more than the cost of what we're producing
Well,
and
I think
selling.
that those four items that Jim highlighted, which was a baler, fertilizer, fuel, and labor, has increased between 800 and 3,000% in the same time that
Right.
the cost of or the value of the product we're selling increased at a rate of 181% in those particular numbers. And there's lots of different points he used for. But yeah, that's pretty wild difference.
But those who have changed, I mean, they've always been able to make money. Those who haven't changed, I mean, they are struggling hard right now. One of Jim's examples was in 1970 or 73, I think he said it took 20 calves to buy a new pickup. Today, even with record high, calves have never been this high ever in the since the beginning of history. But with record high calves, it takes 58 calves to buy the same pickup or new pickup. It's a changing world, and if you don't change the way you're doing things, when these prices drop, it's going to be ugly, I'm afraid. So don't be
What?
afraid to change.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a depressing conversation for another day. We'll focus on your building a business today.
Next point I wanted to say is a business that is not growing is slowly dying. You know, I don't know. I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, why do you need to get bigger? Well, I need to help more people. And I think once you say, okay, this is big enough, you're starting to go out of business.
So that was a question that I wanted to ask for you because you probably could have made a living selling the bulls that you could produce on your own on your ranch back in the 1980s or whatever this was. Yet you chose to for some reason, continue to grow and expand and scale to where you're now working with 30 something producers in 13 different states and sales all around the country. You know, why, I guess. And you kind of touched on it a little bit there, but I'd ask you to maybe expand on that a little bit
Yeah.
more because I think
I
there's a
think
lot
it
of
was
businesses
my
that do
passion
that.
and not just mine, but our passion to help more people. I mean, I could sell 100 bulls a year. That's not helping that many people. But there's a lot of cow-calf operations out there that need to do some things differently, and we know how to do it. You know, I look back and I say, you know, I created a monster, but it was a successful monster, and I still enjoy doing it. I think part of that, if you're going to grow, you need to surround yourself with good people, smart people, and good people make you look good, and I think that our producers, they make our company look good. During our Colorado Bulwark days, earlier this week, Tuesday and Wednesday, Gary Rhodes, who Gary bought bulls at our very first bull sale in 1991, and has probably bought bulls at every sale since then, at least once a year. But so Gary's been a part of our program forever, but he was helping us evaluate bulls. And he said, I got a cowboy logic for you. He says, if you are the smartest guy in the room, you need to find another room. And I'm a little slow on the uptake sometimes, but you're not going to learn anything if you're the smartest guy in the room. You know, you're not going to grow. You're not going to be challenged. And I think that's powerful. You know, surround yourself, this network that we've talked about earlier, surround yourself with good, smart people.
No, there's so much truth to that. That you can feel it. You can feel being when you're around people who are not necessarily better than you, but yeah, better than you, that are doing things that you want to do, that you aspire to, that are pushing you to be better. You can feel, I felt it anyway, when I get out to a Faro Cattle Company sale and I'm surrounded by these cooperative producers and these other customers that are ambitious, aggressive, intelligent, folks. I feel excited that I don't feel when I get around you know, certain groups around here necessarily. And that's powerful. Yeah.
And we've always noticed that, you know, a Pharaoh bull sale is not like any other bull sale. I mean, we've got people here that know how to make a living. They know how to make, you know, store up wealth. They want to help everybody else. Yeah. You know, that was Chip Hines, you know, my mentor is now gone, but, his whole life was built around helping young ranchers make a success. And,
yeah. And I think it's not even so much like the things you learn. I feel like me with this podcast, a lot of the things that get talked about on this podcast, y'all are probably listening to thinking, I've heard this before. This is nothing new. But at least with me, when I listen to podcasts or I have these conversations, it's not necessarily the things that I pull out of it specifically, but just the excitement that, you know, you raise yourself, you pull yourself to the next level of, you know, you kind of almost, yeah, you set the bar higher for yourself when you're surrounded by people who are setting the bars high for themselves. It's not just about the things that you pull out of them that they teach you.
That's why if you're the smartest guy in the room, you should look for another room because you're not growing.
Yeah.
You know, along the same line, you know, I think we always need to be a student. You're never going to know everything. And with changing times, I mean, what you learn is going to be different than what you learned 5-10 years ago.
Yeah.
A lot of times I talk about Michael Gerber's E-Myth book, Ranching for Profit, uses that book quite a bit. But in his book, E-Myth, Michael Gerber says, if your business depends on you, you don't have a business. You have a job and you're working for a lunatic. And I heard that back in probably the early 1990s. And that applies to me a lot. It applies to you. You know, if you can't get away because your business depends on you, you don't have a job. You have a job and you're working for a lunatic.
Yeah, a job with really bad PTO policy.
Your business should be working for you, not the other way around. And I know farmers and ranchers have a hard time. They struggle with that, but they shouldn't.
Yeah. So somewhere along the line, like now you share in your newsletters a lot that you have a cabin that you go to when you can. Obviously there's certain times that you're not able to, but how did you develop a system around Pharaoh Cattle Company to allow you to be able to get away for a cabin for a week at a time and enjoy, you know, that very much necessary recovery time, I guess, away?
Yeah. I'm probably not as advanced in that area as you want to think I am. As an entrepreneur, and I think we as entrepreneurs, I mean, we have the hardest time creating a business that doesn't depend on us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the advantage I have is I don't have to be in this office answering the phone all the time. I've got people, you know, I've got three other people that can take care of most of those calls. Now, they may want to transfer them to me. They can do that when I'm at the cabin. I may not, you know, I'll call somebody back. I've got internet at the cabin and, you know, I can write it. We send out weekly emails. I can write one of those up there. I don't have to be home to do that. So, you need to create some time for other things or you're going to stop enjoying what you're doing.
But I mean, you mentioned you brought on people to do a lot of the things that require you being there. And so that's, you know, there comes a point in every business. And I think you or somebody I've heard in the past is it's probably before you think you need it or you should get to the point where you're hiring somebody else.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember probably, I don't remember the first outside family employee we got. I think we already had somebody in the office to answer the phone, but we thought, well, and this may not be the first, but you struggle over that. I mean, if you're going to pay somebody a good salary, you say, man, will that pay back? But I don't think I've ever hired anybody that I didn't get paid back for. You know, that's we hired a young guy to help us build 20 miles of fence one summer. And 10 years later, he was still here. I mean, he was very valuable to our program. But
sure,
go back to the Michael Gerber thoughts. If your business depends on you, you don't have a business, you have a job. There's a lot of things. I think most farmers and ranchers enjoy technical hands-on work. And I'm not against that. You know, I love to ride a horse. I love to, you know, there's a lot of things I love to do. But at the same time, I need to take time to drive the desk. And most farmers and ranchers, I mean, they'd rather be anything but sit down at a desk and do some goal setting or making things happen. But if you can hire somebody for $30 an hour or $20 an hour to build fence for you, to do this, to do your farming, while you're doing a $500 an hour work, that's what we need to be doing. And that's working on the business instead of working in the business. Yeah. And that's a Michael Gerber thing too.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm getting down towards the end of my notes, but a business, your business, anybody's business must be both profitable and enjoyable to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. And I talked to a college professor in New York earlier today, and her definition of sustainability is totally different than mine, but I think I changed her mind.
Yeah.
Sustainable business, whether, no matter what the business is, it's not sustainable if it can't be passed on to the next generation.
Yeah.
And I'm huge about the next generation. I'm huge about, you know, figuring out some way so that the family farms keep going on and on and on, but they have to be profitable and enjoyable. The reason the average cow-calf producer is over 60 years of age is because a lot of the next generation, they don't want to have a full-time job and then another job on the farm. I mean, they'd rather enjoy life more than that.
No, and I think we've talked in the past about, you know, I think we maybe even had episodes talking specifically about how we make the business more profitable and enjoyable, the business of ranching and stuff. And yeah, being able to, well, we've talked about getting away already here today and stuff and the importance of that. But I guess kind of the last question then that I would have for you is going to be around that topic. I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, but succession and the long term, you know, if you've developed a business, we've talked about, Robert Kiyosaki talks about the difference between the cash flow quadrants. There's employees, there's self-employed, there's investments, and then there's business ownership, which is almost classifies almost as an independent business that can operate with or without you. I mean, right. When you start talking about succession and the ability of a business to operate without you, how have you thought about or begun to plan and prepare for the long-term succession and of this business, of your business?
Yeah, you know, I was in business for close to 20 years before I even thought about succession. But I think the sooner you start thinking about that, how do we pass this on to the next generation or to who, somebody that can take it and go farther? And it's been probably the main concern in Farrell Cattle Company for the last 20 years. You know, how do we do this? And I'm going to tell you what we're doing here, and this will be the first time that this has been publicly said. So some of you are going to hear this for the first time.
Yeah.
And but it is happening. We're in the process. We spent about 2 years, you know, with lawyers and various other entities trying to say, okay, what are we going to do here? How do we keep Farrell Cattle Company selling bulls to customers, you know, for another 10 years, 100 years? And what we've done, we're in the process of selling ownership shares in Farrell Cattle Company to our producers and to some of our employees. And that's probably taking place this month is when we'll start seeing, okay, we got other owners in this company. That changes everything.
Yeah.
You know, Deanna and I started this business from scratch, and this is a tough thing to do, but we have some real talent in our producers. I mean, the stuff you're doing with your podcast, Robert does with the Herd Quitter Minutes, and Bobby does with his articles. Rob has shared articles. you know, Pharaoh Cattle Company will always be the same people, the same genetics, the same philosophies. You know, we just need to make sure that it has the business maintains the opportunity to go forward in the future. Mm-hmm. And I think this is going to be good. I mean, you're kind of a second generation cooperative producer, and you've got a third, you know, next generation. Hopefully you're going to have a kid or kids that want to do what you're doing.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. Yep. No, that's really cool. I think that's one of the probably hardest conversations to have, but the most important ones, is to make a plan. And you see it all the time with farms, specifically ranches, where they don't have that discussion and the senior generation passes away and it falls apart and it's sold off and it's done. And so in any business, be it in agriculture or solar sales or whatever business a listener might be in, having a plan for the long term, if that's something that's important to you, is going to be an important part. So no, I appreciate you sharing that and the intentionality you've put for years now in developing that plan. But do you have anything else, I guess, that you'd like to share or address on this topic before we start to wrap up?
I probably covered most everything. I enjoyed having the opportunity to think this stuff through. I renewed a passion to help the next generation. To help the next generation, we've got to help this generation be more profitable, to enjoy what they're doing, to love what they're doing. And then the next generation is just going to fall in there. But you can't, as cow-calf producers, we can't continue to do things the way we've always done them. Things have got to change, and they are. You know, it's unfortunately a lot of outfits aren't going to change until they're forced to change. And at that point, it's probably a little bit too late. But if you can be on the ahead of the curve, it sure makes it a lot more fun.
Yeah. Yep. No, I agree. If folks are wanting to make changes in their ranching businesses and they want to start with the genetics, I guess, and spring sales are coming up here soon. I think you just finished a round of maybe evaluation days here over the last couple of weeks. When are the dates and locations of those sales? I'll maybe give you an opportunity to plug those. Okay. And where can people continue to learn more or hear about or read your newsletter, sign up for your newsletters and updates?
You can go to our website and sign up for our weekly emails or newsletters, or you can, if you put our phone number here, you can call here and we'll get you subscribed. But all of our bull work days, we worked over about 560 bulls in Texas, Missouri, and Colorado. Those have all been done. We're in the process of cataloging, I think it's about 460. So we've taken some of the bulls out already. The Texas sale will be our first sale Tuesday, April 2nd. 2 days later, we'll be in Missouri for Thursday, April 4th, and then back in Colorado on the 15th of April.
Cool.
But we're working on the catalog now. They should be sent to the printer by the end of this month and mailed out in March.
Well, thanks so much, Kit. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts. Like I told you beforehand, when you sent me some of these notes that you had put together, this could be the start of the book that we're all looking forward to reading someday. But I appreciate you putting them together and sharing them here on the podcast.
And I like I said, I never know how much I'm going to enjoy something until I do it. But I want to help other people.
Yeah.
Do things like this and, start a business, make a business, make your business more successful. And so, this will go into a newsletter or a update or something. Yeah. And that book that we keep talking about, it'll be in there too.
Perfect. Good. No, well, thank you, Kit. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Herd Quitter Podcast is brought to you by Pharaoh Cattle Company. His mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.